Welcome to yet another episode of Innovation Odyssey. Today, I have with me in the studio, Jessica Druko. I didn't get that right.
It's okay.
Who is the founder and CEO of Riverkin. Please prevent me from massacring your last name.
It's okay. It's Druko, but that's also how my sister and I have decided that because it's a Ukrainian last name and it's pronounced differently in Ukrainian. So when we come from Canada, so we decided that we pronounce it this way since it's our name. So we pronounce it as Druko.
Okay. Oh, I like it. You already have mentioning two nationalities, which I like because that's what the podcast is about. But let's start. You know, I like to start with giving the guest like a 30-second elevator pitch. Who are you and what do you do?
So I'm Jessica, and I'm first and foremost a whitewater kayaker. I love rivers. I grew up on rivers. I was born on the Niagara River. I grew up kayaking every summer on the Ottawa River. And both of these rivers confluence in Montreal and create the St. Lawrence River, which is where I did my bachelor's in mechanical engineering. And what do I do now? I'm completely on a different continent in Switzerland, instead of in North America, and now in Europe. And I am basically, creating a worldwide water monitoring network as part of my startup.
That just very purpose driven, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I studied combustion. I studied a little bit of aerospace, and I really like reactive flows, and I like the science, thermodynamics, fluid dynamics. But working in the field, specifically in combustion technologies, it wasn't a very fun field to work in. I mean, it didn't really give you a big perspective for the future. So I really wanted to switch and do something that was closer to my heart, which is working in the hydrological cycle.
So what you did before, why did you say didn't have a perspective for the future?
Yeah, just in Europe now, we're moving away from fossil fuels. So we're moving away from using combustion technology for, so big natural gas engines is what I was working on for the purpose of providing electricity for entire cities. And this is being completely phased out in Europe. So there was a few times at the previous company I was working in where people lost their job. They came to work one day and lost all of their jobs. And I was an intern, so I costed nothing. So I didn't have any fear of losing my job, but I knew that it wasn't a field that I didn't want to go into. Just because I don't see a future for burning fossil fuels.
Provocatively, why rivers and why not oceans?
Yeah, I mean, many people are focusing on the ocean. I think the ocean is super important. There's a lot of things that people are focusing on the ocean. You can think of microplastics or of phytoplankton or of a lot of different issues, overfishing, not enough fish, not enough big fish. But one aspect that is important for every single person in the world is fresh water. And we do not think about our freshwater systems that much. I think we take water for granted. Water is kind of a niche topic, what I've learned about, even though everyone is so dependent on it. Almost every industry is dependent on fresh water. Every person is dependent on having access to clean water for drinking, sanitation. Yet somehow it's still a niche topic. There are still water specialists. Many people don't think about fresh water. The ocean is, I don't want to say it's hyped, but I think freshwater systems, you know, that's my goal. I would like to kind of give them, more of a spotlight and an understanding in people's lives.
Okay. And what do you have, a device, a software that monitors the rivers?
Yeah, so what we're focusing on right now at Riverkin is we are deploying the first worldwide water quality monitoring network. So we are really focusing on capturing high spatial and temporal resolution water data. So right now, when you look at risk, at water risk, what is the, if you're a food and beverage company and you're looking at years into the future, what is the risk that you actually have water to create your products? Without water, you don't have any food or you don't have any beverage products. I think it's the main ingredient of most of these beverages. And so there is a sense of like they need to secure water for their product. But also water is becoming more scarce, and more regulations are coming in surrounding water. So it's not only managing your water risk in terms of will you have enough water to do your operations, but also water risk is about how do your operations affect water? So how do they affect riparian zones, which are zones at the interface of freshwater and terrestrial ecosystems. As I'm using these words, I'm realizing they're very scientific, and that's because I just finished my PhD in hydrology and water resource management. But yeah, like water risk, it could be, how do you pollute the systems, and then how do you expose yourself to large fines? But also how does polluted water enter your system and then affect your operations? Or how do you mess with basically the entire hydrological cycle? So there's a lot of water risk that companies face, but quantifying this water, before you can actually react to this risk, you need to quantify it. And to quantify it means a lot of modeling or forecasting or measurements. But to create these models of forecasts, you need measurements, and that's where we come in. So that's what our network will be used for. It will be used for informing biodiversity metrics. So now every company in Europe will have to start quantifying their effects on biodiversity. But none of these companies, these startups that are quantifying biodiversity, have a freshwater component because there's no data. So this would be one aspect. I don't want to talk too long. Now I'm going. I feel like I've given a big overview.
No, it's very interesting. And we, I mean, isn't 85% of the world water?
I don't know exactly how.
Yeah, but like it's a big amount, right? And that is not. To know that in people that look at biodiversity, they don't assess, monitor water, that's slightly scary.
It's because, I mean, what they do right now, what a lot of these companies do is they take global data sets and then they downscale them. And then they try to also look at satellite images and they try to extrapolate what is the industry's effect on freshwater biodiversity. But the problem with satellite images is that you don't actually get satellite images when there's a rainfall event or when there's clouds. So you don't have any real-time data about companies' operations and how they're actually affecting freshwater systems. The other issue is, in addition to these global data sets, you really don't have any in-situ data. So any data that's actually telling you what are the real-time or close to real-time effects of the industry on the freshwater ecosystem.
So since they're already using something, imperfect, but they're using something, and you are doing something that is very focused and specific, by what percentage are you improving their vision? And more importantly, are they willing to pay for that percentage improvement in vision? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this question. But go ahead and let me know what percentage, what is the improvement?
So the improvement, I mean, in quantifying in percentage, I can't say. But the difference is that, so right now, exactly that's the question. Who is willing to pay for the data? Like, do people actually care about this percentage in improvement? right now, this kind of quantification is really only coming from governments pushing the industries to make these assessments on the biodiversity side. But on the, for example, if we go back to food and beverage, their entire business case is built around water, and there it's basically life and death for them, because if they can't secure that water, or if they pollute the water, they face extremely hefty fines in the multi-million, hundreds of millions. So the business case specifically for food and beverages, yeah, consulting and helping them to avoid over-extraction or polluting of the river system.
I mean, and going back to why I asked the question, it's like I come from insurance background, right? And so my area has been using data to capture trends in, very broadly, trucking accidents, right? And so there is a big gap, which is why I had my company. And now I find a lot of companies that, like, you know, look at how the brakes of a truck can contribute to the accident. It's interesting, but at the level that an insurer uses the information, it's useless. Because it has to flow through the entire value chain of pricing, get priced in. So that's why I asked the question of, like, how important is the impact that you're having going to be priced? Because that'll ultimately impact your uptake from your clients. So it seems to me as though food and beverages is a natural fit as a client. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yeah, and another client is, for example, hydropower. So hydropower plants, the issue is now with increased weathering. We have a lot more, and with climate change, we have a lot more fine sediment that is being transported by river systems. And this fine sediment ends up affecting these operations, hydropower operations. We want this bed load, so that's the bigger boulders inside of rivers, and also the fine sediments, which is the stuff that's floating. We want it all to move downstream. But the problem is that all of these industries along the way affect this sediment cycle. So hydropower really holds this bed load and the sediment load. And gravel mining, for example, releases this sediment load when they're mining for gravel. They release these fine particles. So specifically for hydropower, on the one hand, there is now stricter regulations coming where they're trying to control the forcing hydropower or incentivizing hydropower plants to reestablish this bed load, because it's so important that this trickles downstream. So that's the incentive. But on the other hand, it's also in the best interest for the hydropower plant to not have these sediments settle in their plants. First of all, because of turbine abrasion, when you have this sediment laden water going through the turbines, it destroys the turbines. That's the first thing. But then on the second hand, when it settles in the reservoir, it ends up filling up the reservoir. So you end up losing capacity of the plant. And there's one plant that we work with in Graubünden where half of the plant is filled with sediment. So that's like 12 meters. So they're really working with the hydrological cycle, not just has benefits on people, on biodiversity, on the hydrological cycle, but also helps companies, yeah, instead of working against it, to work with it and then improve the efficiency of their operations.
Okay. And your scope right now is Switzerland?
No. So right now we are focusing, we have one client in Switzerland, and then we have a few clients in Europe. But we also have a lot of international traction. We have a lot of also international traction, not just in North America, but in the global south. But the issue is that our product, we're still innovating on it. And I mean, I just finished my PhD, and it's an outcome of my PhD. And we really don't want to go start installing these places first of all, in locations where we can't debug because we can't visit the sensor, the sensors. First of all, second of all, in places where the people are really relying on the information, relying on them as early warning systems to understand what's happening. And then it's just not working. So we really don't want to start deploying them in places until the product is a little bit more mature.
What does the product, the monitor, look like? Is it like the size of a small shoebox? Is it even smaller? What does it look like?
It's like a sensor. It's like 65 millimeters in diameter and 20 centimeters long. And it has a cable to a box, which sends our data remotely because the sensor is submerged underwater and you can't send data through water. So we have to have this cable to then send the data abroad.
So is this something that you fashioned? Like you made?
I did. I made everything. I was a one-woman show till about a month ago. Yeah, so I built the sensor myself. I have no experience in electronics. I really started day one of the PhD with an Arduino. It's a small PCB, printed circuit board. It's basically a little computer that you can run different programs. And it's specifically made for like hobbyists, people that want to start playing with kind of electronics. And so I started with this hobbyist board, and now I ended with a product that is installed in 10 locations. And it's a little crazy, but I mean, it was also a long process. It was a 4-year PhD. I had a lot of input from and help from technicians, from advisors, a lot of tears. Yeah.
Does it have a name?
Yeah, this version is called the Hydro Heidi. Yeah. Previously they were named after different rivers. Like the first one it was like prototype 1, prototype 2, and then Rhone, and then Hinterrhein, and then Emme. And then I started to ask ChatGPT for more interesting names, and it came up with Glacier Guard and Hydro Heidi. So
like Heidi as in like the Swiss Heidi.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing, amazing. Okay, so like on the box, does it say HH or does it say Hydro Heidi?
No, it's just everything is just black.
Okay.
It's nothing, no branding yet. Okay. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's, you know, I don't usually have a lot of people doing hardware on the show. Uh-huh. Because my world is also very different, right? It's software and doing data and things like that. So this, I'm so curious to see it, because then you place it. Like, you know, I place you, I place what you're doing. Not that I can't place you now, but when I see it, like, I know exactly what I'm talking about. So it's do you carry it with you everywhere?
No. Right now, we don't even have enough prototypes to debug. Because I built some for the client, and now my CTO, he's like, we really need, if we want to debug them, we have to build more. So that's what we're focusing on right now. It's like building, about 5 so that we can focus on, drift, temperature drift, other types of bugs that it has, and really debugging these. Yeah.
And is it patented?
No, actually, originally it's published as an open source sensor.
Wow, very nice.
Yeah, so for me, it was really important because this project came out of my love of rivers. What people told me originally was when I was exploring what to do next, they said I should build this sensor because people don't have data. And so I did. I built it as open source with the intention that the hydrological community would build them themselves. And the first open source paper came out in 2021 or 2022, I don't remember. And no one has still built it. And what I realized in that time is that the hydrological community really appreciates open source because it's data and you want to trust the data. But in practice, people still would rather buy than build. So we are still exploring whether some aspects we would consider patenting or not. But for now, this is kind of more pressure coming from investors and less so from actual real purpose. And I think it's really coming from investors having a very narrow, in my opinion, way to secure their investment. But in reality, maybe some investors are going to listen to this and tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, which is completely fine. They may say that, I don't care. What I think is more important is the data. I think when you have this type of data, this type of worldwide global data sets, you can really build unique models. You can really inform many other data sets. You can create new products. And this is what our end goal is, not patenting the sensor, which can then be copied anyway by other countries. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the people, the investors, or those who say that, they always miss the forest for the trees, right? And it's just that, like, it's like someone telling me, do you want to patent a telematics device? Because in the big scheme of things, no one cares. It's the data that comes in from a telematics device in front of a truck that looks at the driver behavior, which gets modeled, which eventually becomes useful for autonomous trucks. You know, there you're playing the really long game. So the goal then really is actually, I mean, it's a little bit of like the proprietary, more than being worried about the patent on the device, I would think a little bit about the proprietary data and how that can help you win scaling your vision while also helping others.
Yeah, exactly. I think also when we're thinking about what can we actually build with this data that keeps us with a competitive advantage, it also forces us to think beyond just the patent. Because I also think it's kind of like a false sense of security. You think, oh, we have a patent, now no one is going to compete with us. And in reality, that's not the case.
Okay. And do you do any, I mean, I have recently been involved in several space ventures by some accident. Is there any link to something that you want to do extraterrestrially?
Well, our product is really also informed, like what we do with our models is that we use the raw data that we collect, but we also use space observation data to inform our models. So to send them to space, I don't think so, but to use space products in our product, absolutely. And actually we're part of the European Space Agency Accelerator.
Okay. Beautiful.
Yeah, ESA BIC, the Swiss accelerator, like the specific Swiss business incubator. And what we're going to do, what we're implementing is using different space products. That's the digital elevation model or landscape cover or satellite images. So different types of products to then inform our models. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll make a link to someone who's doing some very interesting work around space on the data side.
Okay, thank you.
So, yeah, it's a she, and there's always a big need for women in STEM. Mm-hmm. I think you will make a good link, and she's very good. So I'll do
perfect,
that.
Thank you.
So you mentioned a few things that you said. I'm from Canada, but you're Ukrainian. So, and now in Switzerland. What's the story?
The story is always that the eldest daughter has to leave home and move to a different country. Yeah, so my grandma had to move from Russia to Ukraine. When my mother was born in Ukraine, she moved to Canada after the USSR. She had the opportunity, she was sponsored to come to Canada. And then I was born in Canada, And my younger sister is still in Canada, but I moved to Switzerland. And I will probably continue this.
I know the feeling, and I think it's kind of actually interesting for the firstborn to move, because the firstborns usually do a lot of the things, right? They have been somehow enabled by their order of birth to do these things. They all also have the more pressure. So, and how has so you don't you've never really been in Ukraine when you were young.
No, I mean when I was young, yes, but not recently. Mostly my whole family lives in Canada. We have a few relatives in Ukraine, and we also have a few relatives in Russia.
Okay. And which part of Canada?
The small business capital of Canada, which is Niagara Falls. Yes.
Wow,
Is
okay.
it what you expected?
I didn't expect anything. I just like always, I always associate Niagara Falls with the hot sauce.
Oh, okay. No, I mean the small business because everyone there has a restaurant or a tourism company or something like that. I mean, I think 95 or more percent of the industry revolves around tourism. So this is where I'm from.
I mean, I used to study in Toronto, study slash work in Toronto, so I would drive across. So I mean, I'm familiar with that, but all this just I used to come there for the hot sauce. Don't ask me why. And how was Switzerland? How long have you been in Switzerland?
I've been here 8 years, and I came here for the master's and I liked it enough, so I stayed for the PhD, and now probably for a long time, probably I will stay here.
You think that coming from like a background where your parents had to move and then you move, do you think that informed your choices in what you did?
My sister and I didn't really have this Canadian identity. I mean, I feel out of all of my identities, I'm probably most Canadian. But also I've been here for a while, so I feel also like I'm part of society in Switzerland. I speak German, I understand some Swiss German. But here in Switzerland, people are also very how do you say, like selfish with the identity. So they don't really allow you to call yourself Swiss.
Well, I mean, you can, and then just, have them react to it or
Yeah,
not.
but it's different. In Canada, really, this question, like, where are you really from, is kind of very taboo. Canada is a melting pot of many different cultures. So anyone can really be Canadian. So I also identify most as a Canadian there, but growing up, my sister and I were always told that we're not Canadian, that we're, Russian or we're Ukrainian. And they were very kind of upset when we showed these North American qualities. So this is also kind of something difficult, I think, growing up as like a first generation in a different country. So for me, I would say that link of not having an identity to link to a specific country kind of made it easy to move to a new country.
I think that that is true, and I mean, or like I think in my case, I am of Indian origin, and I spent quite a lot of my years in India, but I think that my identity was so well established then, because in India, you come from a certain state or whatever, and you are that it was so well established that it was actually easy for me to move too, right? Because so either you don't have it. Or you have it, and then you make the choices,
Maybe,
right? And I'm a rebel in that I look Indian, but I'm not Indian. No, I'm not. So I have like parts of me that's very American, And parts of me that is very, very Swiss too.
What are the most American and Swiss parts of you?
Oh, the most American part of me is just like, oh my God, like, can we just do it? You know, I don't care. Just to go do fail, that kind of attitude. That's the very American part. And I think the Swiss part is, even if I go jump and do it, I'm actually going to be slightly cautious. It's a little bit of a chess game. Like I make my moves very strategically. And I think the Swiss are kind of very, there's a word for it. They're very, not cautious, but they're very, maybe I could even use the word cautious. They don't jump in and do everything, but they plan and they do it. The execution is really carefully done. So I'm a little bit of a blend of that. And I also realized that staying here, I really value the calm of the country, you know, especially having born in India, and the calm helps with the chaos. And that is something I actually now at this point in my life identify with. But I also think that, at least for me personally, having the flexibility to live in different countries, it clearly has made me who I am. So I always think that that is a big factor of which is also the reason for the podcast, right? Someone who picks up and moves is more likely to do different things than someone who stayed down. And it's a question of why did you move, and what are you doing now that you may not have done if you were in Canada?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually kind of how. So I have one, whenever I don't know what to do, I have this one guiding principle. And it's, I recently was introduced to the word happenstance, which I had actually been doing for the last 10 years, but I didn't know it had a word. So for me, when I had my when I was accepted to McGill again for the master's, because I did my bachelor's there, I was also accepted to UBC, and I thought, oh, that's great. That would be super cool to move to Vancouver. And then I was accepted to ETH in Zurich. And if I stayed at McGill, life in Montreal is really one of the best places in the world. I think I don't know anyone that doesn't like Montreal, that hasn't visited Montreal and doesn't love the food, doesn't love the lifestyle. You can kayak there. It's just one of the best places in the world. The group that I was in was amazing. The professor was amazing. So really, I was just going to continue my life, like an awesome life. So, and then the other option was to move to Vancouver, which is, you've probably seen photos of Vancouver. You've heard about it, the lifestyle, it's beautiful. It would be something different, but I know people there, and I knew like maybe the group wouldn't, I don't know what the group is like, but it would be an option. And then ETH, no clue. Don't know anything about Zurich, don't know anything about the language, didn't know anything about the university, about what my life would turn out. How it would turn out. And that's exactly why I chose it. Because for me, when you like Montreal was exact, I knew exactly how my life would look in 10 years. And Zurich, I had no idea where I would be in 10 years. And that's exactly why I chose it, because I had the opportunity and I was open. And I think when you're open, you allow these opportunities to come into your life. And that's also happenstance, I guess. So now whenever I have this option of like doing something that's very clear and concrete, the other option where it's a little more open leaves a lot more room for growth and imagination. And this is the more interesting path, I think.
Yes, I mean, you are speaking my language, and I think that probably you and I do it without thinking even. I mean, now we are able to put words into it, right? We're saying this is what we do. But when we do it, it's literally we are following our gut. And I've now reached a point, and I'm sure you will too, that this becomes default. And so you because you're an entrepreneur, right? And then you start doing things that you are just naturally out of your comfort zone. And sometimes, like, I listen, look at other people's faces when they see what I'm doing, and I use that chance to quietly recalibrate. Like, is this me doing crazy stuff because this is normal for me? Is it really worth it? Like, you know, you got to recalibrate, because you go that path, you're down that path forever.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy about that, because there are actually not many people who do what we do in terms of not just being an entrepreneur, right? But just deciding to move and then start something. I'm pretty sure when you started your company, you had no idea how to do these things.
No, I still don't.
That's good. That is good. And that's, I think, that's the part, right? You're open, you're flexible, you let the magic come. And then because you're open, you also find people who will help you. And I think the biggest advantage and this of being open is that you, if you're open to ask for help, the people that you ask for help often write some parts of your story.
I like that.
And yeah, yes, and it's, I think it's very important, because I don't think we, like, your parents' stories were not written by them alone, mm-hmm. right? In circumstances. So you are just now choosing to not be in Montreal and not be in McGill and here. So I think that's very powerful. That's and I mean, if you have your dream, then you would be really monitoring rivers worldwide.
Yeah.
Soon.
Not if, but when.
Yes. Good.
I wanted to say two things. First of all, I will be visiting Montreal this summer. So I'm super excited to go back. And then second of all, now my problem is more focusing. Because now I opened myself up to so many opportunities, and it's actually too much. So now my challenge as an entrepreneur is actually having to say no to a lot of things. No to whatever pitch, to whatever accelerator, to whatever opportunity comes, and being like, no, this isn't our priority as a company right now. Our priority is tuck, 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 one, two, three, and then really trying to just funnel the opportunities into just these three categories, like our top three priorities. So
yeah,
that's kind of my challenge now.
That is a challenge, and I, for all entrepreneurs, is a challenge, but I'm pretty sure that you will ace that.
Yeah, thank you.
And I mean, and that is actually really what, in my opinion, I think that's what really decides the success of a company, right? Can you find your best opportunity now, but not be so, like, close-minded that you miss the next big one for you? Mm-hmm. And that only comes with focus. And I think that it's a very good exercise that you do for yourself, not just for the team, because at one point I'm sure you'll have a big team and they'll be in 100 different places, and you will have to be the one who pulls them in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how big is your team now?
So now we're three. It's okay. Myself, and about a month and a half ago, I started working with, and now just officially onboarded, my co-founder, Marco, who's the CTO. He has a background in robotics and he's a machine learning engineer. And now I handed over everything to him, and it feels so good, like, not to think anymore about, you know, even though I'm an engineer, I feel like I'm not so good at these things about, like, electronics and whatever. Like, I really have this big vision in mind, and he really likes focusing on the nitty gritty of the product. So I'm so happy to hand that over to him. I don't have to spend hours in front of the code debugging, or hours in front of whatever. Yeah, I'm really happy. And then next we're onboarding Nitin, who he is an AI expert, has a PhD in computational biology, and exited two startups. So he really has a knowledge about how to grow and scale a startup. So he's more on the operations side.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's your team tripled, and it's a good feeling, huh?
Yeah, it's really good, but it's also, now my priority is really about the team, which means meeting with them, telling them everything that's in my head, teaching them everything that I know, onboarding them with all of the documentation that I have, it's also a very long process. And I feel like I should be, you know, speaking to my clients and speaking to all these things, but it's a priority because it needs to be done. Mm-hmm.
And are you looking for funding?
We decided as a team that we would raise a very small CLA round in the fall, because from the European Space Agency, we got a grant for 200,000 euros. But to get this money, we have to unlock it with 300K. And then we also have a few other opportunities to get some other money with 300K. So we're really going to focus on raising this small CLA round just to cover their salaries, because the last year I was raising money for my own salary, for my interns, and for about 100K in development costs. So now that I have the team members, I'm like, okay, next priority, cover their salaries. Yeah.
I love the stage of the company because it's just, you know, you're beyond an idea, you're getting some money and you can now really put your feet on gas, right? With the team, you can do so much more than what you can do by yourself. So that's exciting. And that always leads me to a question of, do you feel that you are an entrepreneur or an innovator? The definition is open-ended.
Oh, I think you wrote this in the questions, but I missed this one. An entrepreneur or an innovator? Yeah, my gut feeling says innovator, because I'm really more concerned with creating opportunities and creating new possibilities from what we're building. Of course, that trickles down into entrepreneurship, because actually for me, I always had a focus on how am I going to create this network? Am I going to do it by being a postdoc, by winning a grant, a European grant to install these sensors all around the world? But in the end, I decided that we could have more impact if we did it as a company. And that is the reason that I went down the entrepreneurship path. But in the end, I guess you could say innovator, because we're really focusing dead on this network. Yeah.
Okay. there is no right or wrong answer. You know, it's like whatever. Sometimes, like today morning, you wake up and you feel that you are innovator. Tomorrow, you feel very entrepreneurial. You know, it's just.
I mean, I definitely feel more entrepreneurial by the amount of meetings that I'm in. Like going from doing a PhD where you are by yourself and just your colleagues for lunch to now, like I was only in meetings today from 9 a.m. till now. So I definitely feel like an entrepreneur today.
I mean, you can always withdraw into your scientist shell when you want, right? That's something that you have, and that you will be doing that a lot, actually, because that's mm-hmm. who you are at core. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have the blend of both. And to wrap up, what is your vision of the future of rivers?
Yeah, something that I would really, I mean, that I'm focusing on is not just making this type of data more accessible to more people, and not just creating water insights that will inform decision making and create new opportunities for new businesses. But in the end, I would also, I mean, what I'm also focusing on is changing people's perceptions of rivers. So I think in Europe, if you live in a city, every river is kind of channelized, or it's dirty, or if it floods, it's like, oh, it's bad, it's dynamic, and it's very fearful. And in many other places in the world, water carries a lot of pollutants or diseases. And it's also super necessary for life, for us. And so I think if we have this better connection with rivers, this better understanding, we would also take care of them more. And that means creating stronger policies around them. That means forcing companies to take responsibility, which then ends up improving our health. So for me, I would really like to change people's perception. And so their understanding of river systems is that they're important and that they're not niche.
Well, you certainly have one convert today here. And, you know, there's the power of one. One becomes many. So,
yeah, and we'll see. Maybe everyone that listens to this podcast will also, yeah. So thanks for the opportunity to share our message. Yeah.
So thank you for, you know, spending one of the several meetings today with me on the podcast.
Yeah, no problem. And it was a pleasure.
Yes, and good luck with everything. And I hope I can help.
Thank you. I'll keep you updated.